capital announcement that I see some of you have already availed yourselves of this pamphlet on the back table. It's a story of our trip that we made last fall on these itineraries. The present one is our 12th, and the one last fall, I think, is the one that had more adventures in it than any other we've been through. But this tells how the Lord delivered us out of them all. And it's written so that you can join us in praising the Lord for his deliverances. So anyone who hasn't as yet taken one, please help yourself to one on the back table. I see about 2/3 of them are gone, just one per household. So for our meditation on God's word, let's turn to the book of Deuteronomy chapter 3, where we'll meditate on part 2 concerning thorough victories that are possible. We pointed out Wednesday night that God told the Israelites that when they entered the promised land, they were to conquer and completely eliminate the Canaanite nations in the land. They must not make peaceful alliances with them, or even make slaves of them, or subject them as a colony and tax them. They must wipe them out completely. And Israel got off to a good start under Joshua, but once Joshua was gone from the earth, we learn of one sad case after another in the book of Judges of how this tribe and that tribe didn't drive out the residents of this nation and that nation. However, even before Israel entered the promised land, God brought them to conquer two nations that were not part of the promised land, but they were in territory that he wanted to give them as colonies for their empire. And they did conquer those nations completely and not subject them to be like slaves or to tax them, not make peaceful alliances with them, but wipe them out. They did obey thoroughly concerning these two nations, and that showed that it could be done with God's power. The first of those two nations we meditated on Wednesday night was Sihon, the king. He was king of Bashan. His capital city was Heshbon. And this morning we want to look at the second such case. The two come one right after the other. We want to look at Og, king of Bashan. Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan. And whereas the victory over Sihon and Heshbon taught us that victory is possible over persistent problems, because the victories of Israel over the Canaanites are types of the victories that we can have in our personal lives, whereas the victory over Sihon, king of Heshbon, taught us that it's possible to have complete victories over persistent problems. There's problems that keep coming back and that we have especially hard time to get victory over them. Victory over Og, the king of Bashan, tells us that it's possible to have victories amid frightening requirements. So let's read then Deuteronomy chapter 3, verses 1 to 11, on obtaining victory over frightening requirements. Verse 1, "Then we turned and went up the way to Bashan, and Og the king of Bashan came out against us, he and all his people, to do battle at Edrei. The Lord said to me, 'Don't be afraid of him, for I have handed him over and all his people and his land to you, and you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon.' So the Lord our God handed over Og also, the king of Bashan, and all his people, and we struck him until none was left remaining to him. We took all his cities at that time. There was not a city which we didn't take from them, 60 cities, all the region of Argob, the kingdom of Og in Bashan. All these were cities fortified with high walls, gates, and bars, besides the unwalled towns, a great many. We completely destroyed them, as we did to Sihon, king of Heshbon, completely destroying every inhabited city with the women and the little ones. But all the livestock and the spoil of the cities we took for a prey for ourselves. We took the land at that time out of the hand of the two kings of the Amorites, who were beyond the Jordan, from the valley of the Arnon to Mount Hermon, which Hermon the Sidonians call Syrian, and the Amorites call it Senir. All the cities of the plain, and all Gilead, and all Bashan, to Salica and Edrei, cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan. For only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of the Rephaim. Behold, his bedstead was a bedstead of iron. Isn't it in Rabbah of the children of Ammon? 9 cubits was the length of it, and 4 cubits the breadth of it, after the cubit of a man. So this passage then teaches us that it's possible to win victories over frightening requirements, or amid frightening requirements, because all of us, even the bravest, have certain circumstances that we dread. And our dread of them can lead to sin and failure, because there are times when something that we dread is our duty, so we've got to do it or else sin. To allow ourselves to be held back from it by fear would cause us to sin. And like persistent problems, as we meditated on Wednesday night, so the things that we fear may depend on our temperament or on our aptitudes, because who doesn't dread doing something he doesn't feel he has the aptitude for, or past experiences that leave us marked, or what has been instilled into us that we've been indoctrinated with at some time in the past. And so therefore fears are different for different people, and something that we absolutely dread might seem trivial to somebody else, or maybe somebody else might even find it appealing. Some people enjoy things that others are scared of. And at the same time, we might wonder, what does this other person find to be so scared of in this thing that doesn't bother me? Well, it's because fears are different in different people, but everybody has some of them. And, for example, people with a timid or not so social temperament may dread facing crowds, whereas a person with a very sociable temperament will delight in large crowds. Or everybody naturally dreads something that he just doesn't feel cut out for. And people have various phobias. Some people are scared of heights, some of crowds, some of being closed in, some are scared of the unknown. And all of these have causes. Some even have fears that are ironic. For example, it's said that a certain man who was known as one of the bravest generals in Europe on the battlefield admitted that every time he snuffed out a candle with his fingers, he got scared that he'd burn his fingers on the candle. Well, ironic, but that's the way these fears work. So before we compare ourselves with others and put down somebody for feeling scared about something that we don't see anything scary about, let's remember that God understands all our fears, and he shows compassion toward us in understanding them, and that God will never tell us just to snap out of it when we're hampered by a fear, because he knows that we can't. These fears are real, even if they are illogical in certain cases. But the story of how God enabled Israel to conquer Og, the king of Bashan, and take possession of his land teaches us how God can enable us to overcome fears that hamper our usefulness to him. And it's easy to see how Og was a fearful enemy to Israel. They did have a logical reason to be scared of him. So the story of Og, then, and of Israel's victory over him, teaches us that to be victorious when we are faced with frightening requirements, something we've got to do but we dread it, let us remember that God has them in hand. God has already foreseen what we would naturally be afraid of, and he's taken it in hand. And the fact that God would even tell Israel, don't be afraid of Og, that he would think it necessary to tell them that so soon after they had conquered Sihon, would show that Og really must have been dreadful indeed, because they had just finished winning a victory over a nation much more powerful than they, and yet God seems to find it necessary to tell them, don't be afraid of this one. So Og really must have given a fearful impression, but God understood why Israel was naturally afraid, and he reassured them. And a difference between Sihon and Og was that when Sihon came to do battle with Israel, he had attacked them in response to a request of theirs. They had asked him to let them pass through their land and said, if we require any food or water, we'll pay for it and we'll mind our own business on the way through. But Sihon had reacted with hostility to that request. But Israel hadn't even requested anything of Og. They hadn't done anything to him. And yet he came out and attacked them. So that would make him seem all the more violent to them, because there was absolutely nothing to provoke him, not even in his interpretation of anything they could have done. And the cities of Og's kingdom must have appeared impossible to get into to conquer. It was the region which was known as Argob in verse 4, which apparently was situated on a rocky plateau, an upland that was rocky and might have been even difficult of access. And we see evidence of this in the text, and history tells us further that the houses in that territory were very sturdily built. They had basements in the rock, and the houses had one story or more above, and they had arched roofs of enormous stone slabs made of basaltic rock, which had a heavy iron content, so they'd be very heavy stones and very sturdy. And the walls of both the cities and the houses in them were of stones 4 feet thick that weren't fastened with any kind of mortar, but they were sanded so precisely that they were placed one on another and no air got through cracks in between. And the gates of the city were two paneled gates, so that they were double, and each panel was made of stone 18 inches thick. And it was they were placed on pegs that served as hinges, but because of their exceeding weight, even the strongest of men needed something to push against as he pushed the gates with both hands to open and close them. And they were bolted shut with sturdy iron bars. And it's beyond modern engineers to imagine how it was even possible to build such structures. So some have suggested that if there was a race of giants like Og, maybe with their superhuman strength, that accounts for their being able to build such structures. Well, you can imagine then Israel being afraid to attack such a kingdom. And the requirements that we fear may appear truly dreadful to us, and we wonder how we'll ever handle them. But notice in verse 3 that God is called here by a double title. He's called the Lord God, the Lord our God, or Jehovah our God, to impress Israel all the more with his greatness, to emphasize how great a God they have, and to distinguish him from the powerless false gods of the heathen around them. And when we face requirements that we're inclined to dread, let's remember, if God is for us, who can be against us? Romans 8:31. So the first words that God speaks to Moses about Og are, don't be afraid of him, I'll hand him over to you. And here, then, God was assuring Israel, even before they had time to react with fear, God foresaw what their reaction naturally would be, so he assures them even before they have time for that reaction of fear. So he assures them in advance that he's got it all in hand, and he assured them that their victory over Og would be just as complete as their victory over Sihon had been, even though there were reasons to think he was more frightening. So let's compare what God was doing for Israel with this. Let's imagine a nonprofit organization that is going to have to move some furniture. And it's the old-fashioned furniture that was built with massive hardwood and therefore was dreadfully heavy, not like the lighter modern furniture. And they call on two men who are volunteer associates of the company. Well, certainly if those two men get the message they're going to be asked to move that terribly heavy furniture, they'll wonder, will we be able to handle it? and their wives are going to get scared that they may wrench their backs and be permanently injured. But even before the message gets to those two men that they're going to be asked to move that heavy furniture, a board member of the organization calls them and says, "You're going to be asked to move some heavy furniture, but don't worry, I've already rented a forklift with a licensed driver and some dollies to wheel the furniture on, and all that you're going to be expected to do will be to wheel it into the exact place where it goes." Well, then those men get the assurance that they'll be able to handle it before they even have time to react with fear of how are we ever going to handle that heavy furniture when there's only two of us. Well, it would be very much appreciated. And that's how God dealt with Israel here, and that's how he deals with us when we face requirements that we dread. God assures us even in advance, "Don't worry about it. I've had this in mind. I've known about this since before the foundation of the world, and it's already in hand that I'm going to enable you for it." So this battle, besides the one against Sihon, the two of them, they were fought after Israel's discouragement at Kadesh Barnea. Remember when they sent the spies over the Jordan, and 10 of the 12 spies came back and said, "We'll never be able to overcome those giants." And so they discouraged the entire nation apart from Joshua and Caleb from wanting to go. Well, now that that discouragement has passed and Israel has already begun those 40 years of wandering in the desert that they could have avoided if they had trusted the Lord, now they have these two successive experiences to show them what could have been done in the promised land if they had gone when God wanted them to go. And they see what they have missed. And their outcome then of these two successive experiences would show them what could have been by trusting in the Lord. And when we face requirements or duties that we're inclined to dread, let's remember that God saw them and foresaw them since eternity past, and he's got them all in hand, and he tells us, "Don't be afraid, I've got it in hand," even before we have time to react with fear. So to be victorious when we're faced with frightening requirements, let's remember that God has them in hand. Let's also remember that their fulfillment will be complete. If we've got a requirement that we naturally dread, well, God will enable us to fulfill that requirement completely, not just partially, in spite of the apparent impossibility. And it really is impressive how God did take this situation in hand, because how could Israel possibly get into the walled cities given the structures that they had? The unwalled towns that are mentioned, well, maybe, but the walled cities that had walls of stones 4 feet thick, the men might come out of the cities to fight them, but God had told Israel to eliminate all the women and children as well. And they certainly wouldn't come out of the cities onto the battlefield. So if Israel couldn't get into the cities, how were they ever supposed to obey God's command? After all, the only way that stout walls of any kind were ever broken down in antiquity was with battering rams, that is, big logs that a group of men would carry under one arm, and they'd run up against the city wall and give that log a big heave against it. But first of all, even with that kind of a weapon, with a battering ram, do you think it would be possible to dislodge stones 4 feet thick? I'm skeptical that it would be. And furthermore, I don't think Israel had any battering rams because they had been marching for so long through desert where there were hardly any trees. And it's true that in Bashan, in the north side, there were lots of oak trees, but that was beyond this plateau that was called Argob, and Israel was coming to Bashan from the south. So they wouldn't have gone through that north area where there were lots of oaks. So I don't think they had any battering rams. And if they had, I'm skeptical that they'd have been any help. So how could they ever then carry out their mission of completely eliminating the people who lived in those walled cities? Well, we find the answer in Joshua chapter 24 and verse 12, which tells us that God sent an insect that he calls a hornet in the King James Version. We're not sure exactly what insect, but evidently it was some kind of insect that stings, could be some kind of a wasp. And those insects drove everybody out of the cities, women and children alike, not a soul left in the cities. They all ran out to get away from the hornets, and Israel was able to eliminate them. So God is never lacking away. Who would ever have supposed that God would use such a method to get all the people out of those heavily walled cities? But when God says so, he's got a way, and here was his way. But Israel, in order to completely fulfill this scary requirement, they must not omit the apparently minor issues either. Yes, God got all the people out of the cities, the walled cities, so they could eliminate them, but they must not consider the unwalled towns a minor issue either. Verse 5 says that there were a great many unwalled towns. And those unwalled towns might remind us of issues that seem minor to us. Maybe we tend to be somewhat afraid of them, but not to the point of dread. And yet, in a tense moment of temptation, Satan may even use a comparatively slight fear to cause us to fall into sin. And even if a comparatively minor fear, it might cause defeat for us if we trust in our own strength to overcome it. Remember the example we pointed out at the beginning of that man who was known to be such a brave general on the battlefield, but who was scared to snuff out a candle with his fingers. And smaller issues may even cause worse downfalls than big ones because we're inclined to prepare less for them, because we don't expect to have such a great struggle with them. Just as we're told that quite often people with poor health will live longer than people with good health, because those with poor health have more to keep them reminded to take care of their health, so they do. People with good health often abuse it until it catches up with them and they pay for it. Well, similarly, things that we're not so afraid of, and therefore we forget about trusting the Lord to give us the courage for them, might actually cause worse downfalls for us than things that are so scary that we've got to trust the Lord. So therefore, Israel must not neglect either their need to trust the Lord for the unwalled towns, and there were a great many of them. And God wanted Israel to be concerned not only about getting into the promised land proper, but also in conquering all the land that he wanted to give them as colonies to build an empire. Now, for them to get from where they had come from to the promised land, they had to go through Sihon's territory. So they did, since he refused to let them pass through his land, they had to conquer him to get through. But as for Og, they didn't have to go through his territory to get into the promised land. The way was already clear for them. So why would the Lord tell them then to conquer Og and his land of Bashan? Well, because it was a territory that God wanted to give them as a colony, and for them to fight with him right away would show their determination right from the start to accomplish all that God wanted them to do, not just get to the promised land, but reign over the colonies as well. And let us not shrink back from duties or calls of God that we tend to be afraid of because they don't have any effect on our immediate situation. But let's accept those that concern God's will for our future as well. And this territory of Bashan became very useful to God because the city of Golan was located in there, in Bashan, according to Joshua chapter 21. And Golan was made a city of refuge, because there were three cities of refuge on each side of the Jordan. Well, Golan was one of them, and it was in the territory of Bashan, where Og had reigned. And you know what cities of refuge served for? Not only were there cities, were they cities where priests could settle, but they were types of Christ, because the one who had accidentally killed somebody could take refuge in them until the death of the high priest, and then he'd be judged to determine whether it had really been an accident or not. And they're a type of how we can flee to Christ for refuge when Satan is pursuing us and accusing us of being guilty before God. So to be victorious when we are faced with frightening requirements, let's remember that God already has them in hand. Let's remember that their fulfillment will be complete if we trust in Him. And let's also remember that the size of them makes no difference. No matter how big a requirement it is, it'll make no difference. And there are plenty of evidences of the strength of Og himself and of his kingdom. As we said, with those cities with the two paneled gates that were bolted shut with great big iron bars, we don't find that description of Sihon's kingdom, but we find it of Og's kingdom. And this seems to be designed to impress us with how great the measure of Og's strength was and the strength of his kingdom, and also to impress us with the vastness of his domain. He reigned over a greater territory than Sihon, because Sihon's kingdom covered about 1,500 square miles, whereas Og's kingdom covered about 3,000 square miles. So it was twice as big. And yet the size made no difference. And since it was a bigger territory, it probably had a greater population, so that meant more people to fight with. And the emphasis seems to be on the numbers of the enemies here. In the description of Sihon's kingdom and of Og's kingdom, we find much in common, but here's one difference. Whereas in the description of Sihon's kingdom, we're told that no city was too strong for Israel, therefore the emphasis was on their strength. But in the description of Og's kingdom, we're told that the number of the walled cities, that there were 60 of them in verse 4, and also that the unwalled towns were a great many. So the emphasis seems to be on numbers, and it adds up to quite a big number. Does it ever seem to us, when we have to do duties that we tend to dread, that we've just got one after another and there seems to be no end to them? Well, even then, remember, God is sufficient for them all, because the size of the requirements makes no difference. And even each individual fear might seem pretty big to us, just as the description of Og, the king, as an individual sounds rather scary. Now, most translations speak of his bedstead, although there are some scholars who think that it's a description of a coffin rather than a bed. But in either case, I don't think it would be necessary for either a coffin or a bed to be an awful lot longer than the person put into it. And 9 cubits would be about 13 and a half feet. So if Og was even close to that height, then he would be nearly 1.5 times the height of Goliath, whom David fought with and whom all Israel dreaded. And if he was anywhere near stout enough to need a bed 6 feet wide, you can imagine how dreadfully strong he must have been, unless maybe this was a double bed. But otherwise, he must have been terribly stout and certainly a scary person to face. And we're told that he was the last of the Rephaim, a term that means giants, that is, of that particular race of giants. But that doesn't necessarily mean he was the only giant left, because he was king of the Amorites, and it's been suggested that perhaps the Amorites intermarried with the Rephaim, and that produced some more giants, because Amos 2 and verse 9 describes the Amorites as being tall as the cedars and strong as the oaks. Now, this is probably a hyperbole because we're told that the cedars of Lebanon could grow to a height of 120 feet, and I don't think the giants were that tall. However, even if it's a hyperbole, it would indicate that the Amorites were terribly big people. So probably there were giants among the Amorites as a result of intermarriage with their Rephaim, and therefore probably Og himself was not the only giant Israel had to contend with in this battle, and that they would be scared of. And sometimes when we're required to do what we tend to dread, whether or not we have a great number of such requirements, we feel that each individual requirement is something dreadful, and yet none is too great for God to assure us about, and to assure us that with him, we can overcome the fear and fulfill it. And why do you think in verse 11, Moses asks Israel, isn't Og's bedstead or coffin, whichever it was, in the land of the Ammonites now? He's reminding them that it's still somewhere where they could go and see it as a reminder of what God did for them. As a reminder, God enabled us to overcome men of this height in the past, so therefore he can do it again. And it's a good idea in view of requirements we might have that we tend to dread to make a note somewhere where we can readily come across it of some time in the past when God enabled us to overcome something dreadful, or maybe keep some kind of a token of it as a reminder for the future that God did it for us in the past so he can do it again. So all of us, even the bravest, have certain circumstances that we dread, whether logically so or not. And they could be due to our temperament or to our aptitudes and lack of aptitudes, perhaps due to some past experience that has left us marked, perhaps some ideas that have been instilled into us. But it could sometimes be something that we dread is a duty that we've got to do. Sometimes it has to do with the type of service that God has called us to. There might be parts of the service God has told us, that has called us to, that we enjoy, but there's a certain part of it also that we tend to dread. And yet to shrink back from a duty or from something that God has called us to would be a sin of omission. Now, it is not the dread in itself that is sin. The dread is only the temptation, and temptation isn't sin. We can resist a temptation, but to yield to it would be where the sin would come in. And God may or may not choose to deliver us from the causes or from what causes us to dread a certain undertaking, but whether or not he delivers us from the thing that causes us to dread it, he'll give us the courage to do what he requires of us if we trust him. To be victorious when we're faced with frightening requirements, let us remember that God already has them in hand. Let's remember that with him, their fulfillment will be complete. And let's remember that the size of them makes no difference, because nothing is too big for God to handle. So what do you and I naturally tend to dread, which might be a duty or a part of the service that God has called us to? Well, let's rather trust and prove his sufficiency to enable us to overcome our fears, to act in spite of them, and to do what he requires of us, whether with the fear entirely removed or whether by overcoming the fear. He wants to assure us that all will be well with him, and therefore he tells us in advance, don't be afraid, I've got it in hand. Precious Lord, what a blessing it is to know that thou, who art from eternity to eternity, thou hast foreseen everything that would tend to cause us fear, and that thou understandest perfectly the cause of our natural fears, whether fellow men and even fellow believers understand them or not, and whether they are even logical or not, but thou understandest. and thou hast prepared in advance a way to enable us to overcome fear and dread in order to do our duties. And therefore, we ask for thy strength, thy grace, and for thee to recall to our minds the promises of thy word, of thy sufficiency, to enable us to go forward with thee, even with things that we naturally tend to fear, knowing that thy grace will be sufficient for us. In the name of our precious Lord Jesus, amen. Let's take our hymn books and turn to number 594, Victory Through Grace. And it says, not to the strong is the battle, not to the swift is the race. And by the same token, we could also say, not always to the brave is the victory over fear. Number 594.